This is Manisha Roy, November 7th, 1992. After Initiation, Tape 2 of 3.
Humid and hot. So here you have a summer with humidity. And what does that do if you think of the climate? What is it good for? Summer with humidity, heat with humidity, growing. And I was talking to a demographer once in India. I went back from America once, and I said, you know, I'm getting tired of hearing I was in the university, all the people telling me, when is India going to learn to control its birth, you know, birth control? So I asked this friend of mine who was a biologist and a demographer, who's working directly with the family planning. I said, what is your feeling? Why is it that we have so many births, despite the birth control, which was fairly practiced by then? And he said, you know, it's very interesting. And here's a male scientist talking like that. He said, if you eat an orange or a mango and throw the pit out, just throw it, that's what we do in India, from the train or something, within a week you'll see a sprout in that pit or in that stone. And that's in that area where we were, which is near Calcutta, very humid and hot. So things sprout, things come into life like that. So he's saying to me that fertility, human fertility, is very high. You know, women from the village would come and complain that we have been taking pills, but still we are getting pregnant. So it's such a high fertility because, his theory was, because it was hot and humid. Who knows? But it's an interesting analogy. So all the seasons, the reason all these stories can tell you, seasons might be a lot more important than to realize. And what we have done, we have gotten out of it. We have kept at arm's length. We have to open a window every winter morning to even know that this is winter. It's really sad in a way, but of course we have to. But can we then somehow symbolically bring back the seasons in our life? That's right. Interesting, huh? And the other side is, of course, the family tradition. The grandmother is coming back as the granddaughter. So you have these connections in all directions. But I'll digress from here. So how do you bring the divine into the three elements? The community has to do with the reintegration in that three things. So a community is important. What we're doing right now, we're doing in the context of a community. And what does it do? It does the outer social aspect, the cultural aspect. We can't leave the culture. It's very, very important. The word culture comes from Latin, which has to do with colere, which has to do with taking care. Culture takes care of individuals. And of course, we project all that to the government. We say, take care of our medical issue, you know, insurance, take care of our streets, take care of our roads, take care of our, we don't want more taxes to pay. But the medical insurance is a very big thing now, right now. Because we want to be taken care of by the government, which is the representation of the culture, of the society. So culture is essential. We do things within this container. Culture gives us security that we belong to someplace. Culture gives us mythology, gives us tradition, gives us our literature, our art. So it's extremely important. When you talk about culture, there goes the choice again, or egocentredness. And it's very popular to say, I don't believe in what the society says. It's a common, very common statement of what society teaches us to be the good housewife. As if society is an individual entity right there, and we always feel relieved when we say society is doing it. Society is made of us, maybe made of our unconscious. And I think it's very important, and there I would appeal to the choice, to me is that choice, that we take that responsibility. The society is not out there. It's our creation. Like we create God, we create society. Because we need both. And in some religions, they talk about God needs the worshippers as much as worshippers need the God, which is Hinduism. Yeah.
Europeans who had not property and power and came here and experienced
the power.
Complete riches and went on a murderous spree and committed genocide of plants and animals and people, and now we come
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I always say, when I talk about women and the animus in this culture, I always say that the frontierism, this is what you were saying on the side of it, has to do with women constantly picking up and leaving the home, literally and symbolically. And I think this is my, because it may be my bias again, because I come from a stable culture. And if you look at your heart, all of you, women particularly, I think deep down every woman wants to build a nest, wants a stability, wants a land. And many of you who are now in farm or in islands, this is this attraction for the land, a stable place, is the unconscious desire, need for Americans who are constantly consciously moving. Because anything we do consciously, the opposite is concentrated in the unconscious. And it's very powerful because it's in the unconscious, especially if we don't know it. So if the American dream was to move, both socially and geographically, mobility is a very strong value here. You move. You can never have to stay in the same state, the same place. And this mobility immediately creates the opposite into the unconscious, which is the Greek term, is a wonderful term called enantodromia, which is whatever you do consciously, the opposite happens in the unconscious, which is the need to be in same place, need to stay with one thing, stay with, and see the whole problem, psychological problem, mental health issues, have to do with instability in marriage, instability in relationship, and everybody is dying to have a stable relationship or stability, because the outer life is so much valuing the other. So that, and for women it was very, very, it's a high price women paid, because what they did believe, then believe, that moving is important. Moving with the male, the men, they would, you know, all these long skirt women from the 17th, 18th centuries, the Puritans, the old Mayflower people, and they paid a heavy price of this internal nest building, stability, land boundness, and staying put.
Manisha, how does that fit into our continuing, though, even though there's stability, almost the opposite then of the drive for reenacting instability, you know, the constant change of relationship? I mean, what is that?
Because we don't know that we want stability often. Because we value so much the choice, the control. Of course, nobody would use the word control, but choice is the word which disguises, you know, in disguise. So much movement. We even use the word movement for psyche. This patient is moving. You know, in a case colloquium, we can talk, oh, my patient is moving. So movement is even the metaphor for psychological work. Psyche moves in a way which has nothing to do with the outer movement. It often, as you know from your own life, it often goes backward quite a bit and then goes forward a little bit and goes backward quite a bit, because psyche's movement has to do with being connected to the rest of everything we have inside. And that's what I wanted to get you to get into when I said last night, think backwards and think forwards, because you have to keep connection backwards as well. When you are in summer, you have to think of the spring and you deal with the spring. In the summer garden, summer life, summer clothing. And we know, look at the fashion designers. They immediately start selling spring clothing in winter. Have you noticed that? It's amazing. If you're traveling, because I travel all the time, and if I'm looking for something for the particular climate, I never find anything in the big stores because they're already in the next season. Well, again, now we have to watch one thing. We can do this workshop. Every time we say the word culture or society, we have to stop. Because this is a major projection that we have been gone into. Okay, let's take this statement. I think the rigidity, you're right, is the shadow of the stability. Because if we don't acknowledge the stability, if none of us can say, I think it's a good idea to remain with the same husband for 40 years, although it doesn't happen. But let's acknowledge it, that all of us, like old-fashioned women, would like to have and see, you know, the statement that you see the person grow old. And this is an archetypal need in all of us. It doesn't work, but at least if we acknowledge it and be very unfashionable and say, yeah, I think I would like that idea. It would be so much less work to start with new again, with a new person, learn about him, then we don't need to be rigid.
Outside, that what we do in effect by creating instability is throw ourselves into a place where we have to go back to the self.
And you know, there's another thing, because by saying that I have to change my partner to find a stable relationship, because this one didn't work, I'm also giving my ego a clap, because I'm also telling the ego, you can do it. See, we are nurturing the ego's centeredness. But we can choose. So we keep moving, mobility, we keep moving either professionally or psychologically, partly to give ego the central position and the power also. Because we are setting up a situation where ego is challenged. And I'm not saying it's bad or good, but it has its shadow side. And what you're saying, by this challenge, maybe self is created, and ego and self are coming close, which is true. And that's why divorce can be a tremendous initiation. But also, we have to realize that we are also giving ego a power that ego cannot always fulfill. We are telling, you can do it. And that's when you can do it and you do it. This is complicated. You are giving your youth a chance also. You're going backwards a little bit. And when a woman at 50 goes back to the university, does a degree in law or medicine, she is behaving like a 30-year-old or 25-year-old. And maybe she has to do it. As long as she remembers that she's not a 25-year-old, she's using part of the 25-year-old psychologically and intellectually, but her thing is to do it, to really know where herself is, then it's okay. So I'm not saying that you should do this or that. You should do what you have to do. But just remember that this is only a path to something else.
Yeah. Way back to the chart you had on the feelings that go through, and your culture, you know, and other cultures, we would, a group would socially get together and wail and cry. In our culture, at least this is my personal experience, is when we're going through crisis, I feel personally very shameful to share my rage and to share my
as if you failed something.
Yeah. And so it's almost like, you know, we're not allowed experience. To be open, you have to go to therapy and nobody else.
Even there, as you know, it takes a couple of years before you can show your feelings. You tell all the events to your therapist, including your sexual abuse, but show the feeling is another story. But now you will see something else is coming up. Maybe it's easier to create a ritual. Is there a colored chalk somewhere? No. Okay. This one?
Yeah.
Oh, how nice. Maybe we can create a ritual. This is, since this was your common concern. Can you?
No.
Oh, maybe then we'll have to have a problem cleaning it. It's not important.
No, they're, oh wait, pastels. They might be chalk.
Don't worry about it.
No, it's chalk. Just put a little, let's put a mark on the bottom there.
Okay. Let me see. Yeah, it might work a little bit. Let's take a yellow one.
Yeah, there's no problem.
It can erase? Mm-hmm. If it erases, then it's not.
Yeah, that's a
great idea. Okay. Since most of you are interested how to create rituals, we get to go back to it again and again. I think one clue that comes to me, I didn't think of it until we were talking, and that's why, you know, workshop is wonderful, because you give me ideas and then we can cook it together. Maybe if we start recognizing ego's power in actions we do, things we think and act, then, and realize that ego has, see, when you're young, then ego is in the center, but ego has to go like that man's dream, a bit on the outer edges, and then something else begins to grow here, which is the self, then it's easier to keep all these three in balance. It's easier to contain the community and the ego. Initiate then becomes the ego, but like the kid there, the mother's brother tells him, which is the self figure, what to do. And in the mundane group, all the elder men beat the hell out of these kids, and they are the self-image, not the ego. Ego has no power. So why do you think puberty rites are so severe in many cultures? Because they're trying to get the ego to humble so much that they know, even though they're only 13 or 14 or 12, that ultimately ego really is only a servant to self. Somebody who has to listen.
What I, this morning, just thinking about what ritual is and the fact that you, at the very beginning, you talked about death.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is the facing of the fact that we are finite, but behind us and within us is something infinite.
Internal, eternal, yeah. And once we know that, once we surrender to it, once we sacrifice ego's power to the bigger power, now you see the meaning of the word sacrifice, then ritual would be created automatically. Because no ritual exists without the three factors, the outer community, the ego's lower position, and the presence of the self or God or divine. Two mistakes. First, it might be more difficult for the neurophysicist from Harvard to go to the self. And that's what we see every day in our practice. The more intellectually and otherwise successful you are, my example of the businessman, and the worse it is because ego has already experienced the enormous power. So for the ego to sacrifice, it's not so easy. Only a major crisis, like the one guy's child died from a drug-related driving, drunken driving, and that brought him, like Gore was talking about in his speech, Al Gore, some crisis makes the person who is in politics to realize that power is so limited. So that's first one. Second one, if you have been washing dishes, you may have a much easier chance to realize what self is because you are humble already. Okay, go ahead.
I think that it can be true, certainly. And
but in this culture, it's not easy.
In this culture, yeah, because just because you're washing the dishes and you know you're not a neurophysicist, it doesn't mean that you're close to the self.
No.
In fact, that you're working harder to have the minimum ego, possibly,
yeah,
just to function. So if somebody says, now give up washing dishes and go into the self, then you may
Then we're talking literally again. The idea is that when you're washing dishes, you know, why am I doing this when my cousin is a neurophysicist and nobody really listens to me, they all look up to him. Your ego is actually strong enough to give a chance to yourself to think, but this is what I really like to do. There comes the feeling. If you don't like to do it, then you will find a way to do something which is serving yourself. That's the word I would come back to. In other words, those of you who are in high-power profession, that's the midlife crisis again. Suddenly it becomes boring. Why? Because the neurophysics is not serving the self anymore. And culture may go to hell because at that point you feel, because you know that you have lived what culture wanted you to live, or your parents. But now you have to do it for yourself.
But my experience is that often you will see people say, well, I'm tired of being a neurophysicist.
Yeah.
I'm going to bake bread. And they go on and they have a wonderful, successful career baking bread. But the person who's washing the dishes say, now I'll go and clean up bakery. And they don't suddenly
feel great about that
because the culture is still batting them all day.
Well, I think maybe one of the differences is that we're talking about, you know, an ego that has some structure and an ego that doesn't have much structure at all, that is a product of generations of
denigration by the culture. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't have that sense of strength.
Yeah, that's a good point. Let's stay with that for a while. Yeah?
You have to have a strong ego to be able to sacrifice it. Right?
Which one are you talking about?
Ego, and actually I think a lot of, I think a Zen master like Thich Nhat Hanh, who talks about his best meditations are when he does dishes. If you go down to the local restaurant and look at the busboys and ask them how enlightened they feel in doing the work, they're not going to tell you how enlightened, because actually they're not even functioning frequently as an ego.
Now also they're not only that, they're also looking up to the guy. They think from there that the man who is the physicist is much better off, much happier than I am, because it gives reinforcements from the culture, as you were saying. And then you have to sacrifice, come sacrifice again. You have to sacrifice what others say is the best thing. There you have to go into culture, because it's not serving your soul. No culture is going to survive until individuals begin to see the value of the soul. But you think about the sacrifice part. You had had some.
Well, I was just thinking of the movie Gandhi, the line that I just remember and has affected me so much. And I'm not sure he said it, but it was in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
That all work is holy.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that.
Well, the Protestant work ethics, remember? That's the same thing, but it became more like making money and success. Isn't that what the Protestants, Zwingli and the Calvin was saying? That and the cleanliness is godliness, work takes you to God. See, the Catholics said if you're poor, you have a better chance to go to heaven.
Even Freud said the whole purpose of work is to bring us to love and work.
That's right. And all the later psychologists are talking of the same thing. But we lost that sense. Gandhi appeals to you because he's coming from the other. That's why one has to go to other cultures. But it's there. It's in your system. But it became too literal. Again, we go back to the literal. If Protestant work ethics has become work for a gain, an ego gain. All right? But what Gandhi is saying, that no matter how low the work is, even cleaning the toilet, is holy because it's serving toward the community. And if you remember, I mentioned that spiritual birth of the puberty rite has to do with also a birth into the community. It's service to the community and spirituality, which are same in all cultures. So the spiritual aspect, the sacred aspect, remains in the community aspect. That's the way the presidents should be feeling. They can say, God bless America, but do they feel that they're serving the country is serving the soul? Then we have the perfect society. It's not just making building bridges and the roads, that too. But a good president who is really in touch with himself or herself, if we have one, then they would know that building roads, giving good health insurance, giving good housing projects or whatever, also there's something to it. We're giving all this outer stuff so that these people have the right values to serve their souls. Otherwise, being a president can be a horrendous job. I don't understand how the women want to be president, because look at the surface. It's incredibly difficult. You get criticized constantly, and you don't, because you're driven by the power, so you do it. When you saw Bush the last 2 weeks of election campaign, a 70-year-old man, or what, 69, he worked like 10 of us put together, like a maniac, because power has that power. But it's ego. So ego temporarily can do it. And that's why he didn't get elected. I believe psychologically he couldn't be. Because the Eros, Jung said, Eros is opposite of power. And Eros has to do with relationships. So when you are into power only, then you forget Eros. Eros goes into the unconscious. Well, entangle. So he could easily say, I'm old, I have done it, I failed. He could be humble. And, okay, I don't like Clinton, but okay, they keep saying it, but I don't know that they mean it. Let the country decide. And I think he knew he wouldn't win. I hope he did, because then he was also in touch with himself somewhere. But if you're in touch with yourself, you can't, like a maniac, just go for the power. Now, forget the president. It can happen in a family. It can happen within yourself. Who is driving like a maniac for something? You know it's right. You can be driven rightly when you also feel in the inside good about it. There comes the feeling. Feeling is extremely important. It's the judge. And I always tell women, because they have been following their husbands through the country to find the better pasture, they forgot how to feel. I would like to see a woman, I would like to know, maybe there were some who would say, enough is enough. You go ahead. If you have to go to California for gold, I'm not moving. I'm pregnant, or my little children here, and the animals, I'm not moving. That is the feeling function of a woman who knows the priority and can stand up to it. And I think many women who initiate divorce, often they do it from that. And I have known women who sacrificed all the security, financial security, because they just knew the priority. Suddenly it hits them. And leave the house, they decorated, they built, they designed, they slept, dreamt, had made love within a few days. For some women, that's the biggest sacrifice. So somehow the feeling connects with the ego and the self somehow. A crisis can do that. So another colleague of mine uses the word spine. I like to think of a magnetic field or a magnetic a stick. If you think of ego here and self here, and something has to connect it, often it has to do with feeling, it can be crisis, it's all emotional realm which connects the two sides. And these initiation rites in other cultures make it concretely possible by making people go through the initiation ritual where all three aspects are present. Concretely, sacred, the god or the priest who officiates the god is the image of the self, image of the spiritual father, the spiritual mentor who takes care of the puberty, the boy or the girl, officiates it. And the community is around to participate in the ceremony, and the initiant knows that I am only here serving my mentor. So they concretely enact out what we are doing internally. We have to be aware internally. Now, being an American, you might say you have such a bad time because you don't have this tradition. You also have an advantage because you don't have the tradition, you don't have to depend on the outer system as much. You cannot anymore. You have gone beyond that. It's hard work, but it's also, some things should be appealing to American psyche because you also believe in individuality. So it's individual work. So there you can let ego has its say. You choose to come to a workshop. You choose to go to analysis. You choose. There you do choose. But you choose for a bigger choice, for a bigger purpose. And that's the word I would also use, something bigger than just ego. So I'm going in many different directions and sort of convoluted way. But I think by the end of the day, you might realize that there is no recipe for creating ritual. It's an attitude. It's also some awareness. It's also some sacrifice. Sacrifice of ego's attitude to the life you have led so far, maybe. And it may necessitate some concrete sacrifice, like marriage, like leaving a job, like all this stuff. Otherwise, it gets into the body. And then we sacrifice by disease. And you know, people who have disease like cancer or disease like AIDS, which they know, I talked about death last night, they know they're going to die for sure, sooner or later. We all would die, but they have a date, they have a number. But at the same time, they don't die immediately. Have you ever considered what that is about? Why some people die in a car accident instantly, and some people die after 6 months, after they got the disease or the problem? Because they need this concrete threat to do something with their life. And people say that they got a second chance. And it's amazing what people do with it. It's true, those of you who know anything about AIDS patients and even cancer patients, they really turn their life around. They go through the ritual. Now, a disease is a ritual initiation. And it's a continuous initiation for 6 months. Let's say you have cancer and 6 months you have to live. those 6 months, you are going through all these three stages continuously. And all the emotion then come up, and the emotion then connect ego with the self. And many of them are ready to go, and they even say, it's a wonderful experience. All the movies on death, all the research on death, trying to emphasize how pleasant it can be. Why? That's the satisfaction we have when we are connected to the self. Yeah, those. When you're dying, you're reintegrated into the bigger atmosphere. Whatever your religious faith is, your ashes go into the ocean, somebody mentioned last night, the river, you are getting reintegrated into the atmosphere, okay? Your physical remains. If you have a burial, you're reintegrated into the earth. So whatever, or cremate, you're reintegrated into the fire. So you are reintegrated into the bigger cosmos, the bigger nature, and so on. And then the survivors who love you or loved you are the ones who have to then need this to deal with it. And that's the ritual. Every major change, ritual helps us by the hand to go over.
Mm-hmm. And the process that the people who remain go through, divorce, or when children are reaching adolescence and choosing to leave home, life is thrown into a turmoil. And you're talking a lot about how you're being released into a larger cosmos. Can you talk a little bit?
I think there are also death. The only difference is. It's a tougher death. In a way, the real death, the physical death, is an easier death if you consider the deaths in life. Because then you're released, as you said the word, and that's the word Buddhists and the Hindus use, release. And you know the word they use? Release of the ego. Now, somebody mentioned this item, diksha. This one here, the 15 initiation rite in Hinduism. Which has to do with, really, the word is initiation to spirituality. And the word that is used for that initiation is called release of ego. Diksha means initiation, learning. Release of ego. So ultimate goal is the release of the ego for the self. Now, that's what happens in death, physical death. You're released. Before that, you have all these deaths, symbolic deaths, so to speak. And so there the ego's duty is very important. Ego has to recognize it. So that's the only thing we can start with. The connection to the ego and the self can happen if ego, to begin with, starts the work, which is to recognize. It's very simple. Just to recognize, okay, I don't really do all this. I'm here to just recognize, to accept, to go with it. You know, the hippie movement in the 60s often used terms which were very close to the old cultures, old religions. Go with the flow, Zen. And why is Zen so attractive to the Western world? Because it's the opposite of what Western world teaches ego to be. And Zen says things which are so fascinating. You're crossing a river, and the Zen master says to the student, cross the river. A student sees a bridge there. And he starts walking on the bridge then moves away. And then he decides whether he should swim. And as he starts swimming, the bridge is back again. So things that you hear, the Zen stories, they have no connection to the logic, so to speak. And people are puzzled. Zen stories are very puzzling. What it's saying is that real life is not logical. And if you can be accepting of that, then you can accept any surprise what comes to you. That's another very important thing, is to be prepared for surprises. And in analytical situation, in therapeutic situation, if you have the ego attitude that surprises do happen, you will see how many surprises do happen. People talk about synchronicity, you know, the idea. And they say, oh, you know, the synchronistic things are happening to me all the time. Everything is there. It has been happening all the time, but you just beginning to notice. And then you get the benefit. So ego, all ego has to do is to keep ears and eyes open and relax. Not even so, intensity. Intention brings intensity. All these words are wonderful. But you don't have the, you don't need the intentionality. All you have to need is to be prepared to receive. Now that's the feminine mode, going to the feminine masculine, which is receiving. When a woman is fertilized biologically in her egg by the sperm, as you know, and this is the basic analogy we can draw even to this day, we can interfere with it, we can have artificial insemination, we can do all sorts of stuff, but the less of the old-fashioned way of biological fertilization, one sperm out of millions is chosen by the egg. Now this to me is a choice. And I do believe women have a lot more choices when it comes to their body, not in terms of how to terminate pregnancy or not, but in terms of what really happens within her. Ego doesn't do it. So her egg then chooses one sperm out of, I don't know, there must be a reason what the quality, the qualification of the egg is, maybe strength or whatever, and then the door of the womb is closed. Now see what you hear from that symbolically. A concentration, a focus, a stability, a choosing one out of many. And I always go back to that analogy. And then what happens? That then the fetus is forming, and hardly ever she wants an interference with it. Now, the pro-life people, if they went in that direction, they could make a very strong argument that if then you interfere with this closed gestation. To me, that would be much more appealing an argument. Of course, I'm not talking about the politics on the other side of it, or the biology. Let's say you have pregnancy out of rape and stuff like that. But psychologically, you can make that argument very beautifully. And that's why I think so many people also go for pro-life argument unconsciously, because it is biologically, archetypally grounded on some levels. This is one argument I'm coming up with. There might be others. I have worked with women, and I would say maybe 50% of them, which is understandable, have had abortion. Women between 20 and 35, even older, 40. I have yet to see a woman where the abortion has not been a traumatic, not necessarily negative, traumatic experience. As long as, even if it happens, the problem is that if it happens for scientific reasons or ego reasons, I need an abortion because I don't have time to take care of this child. Or I need an abortion because, of course, she might not admit it. Because in my experience, 90% of the abortion choices were made for ego reason. Okay? Then it becomes problematic, because what happens then you are loaded with guilt. And these are the women that I worked with. They had to work years and years on the guilt of abortion. Of course, it can then be an initiation, because they are going through the sacrifice and the emotions and the anger and the pain. But you don't have to have an abortion to go through the initiation. If you have an abortion, then it can be fortunately turned into an initiatory rite. But the question is why abortion takes place psychologically is often an ego decision. Otherwise, we could not have half of the population going for pro-life, for wrong reasons maybe. They're very fundamentalist. They talk about things that we can't even see, how stupid. But archetypally, there has to be something very profound that they're standing for, as very profound what the abortion group is standing for. That's why when it becomes a Supreme Court issue, we go away from those issues totally. So I had an analyst who kept canceling ours because she had to go for demonstration, pro-choice, with big, nice banner and so on, very activist. So third or fourth time around, I said, fine, you have to do, but I'm not going to give you another time. Third time or fourth time, I told her. Oh, I'm sorry. So she comes back. And I said, so you are sacrificing the demonstration today. Because apparently every time I see her, there's a demonstration somewhere. So, the clash is very interesting. And she said, yeah, I decided, this is more important. So I said, why is this more important? He said, oh, I don't know, I had this interesting dream. I said, let's stay with the emotion. Why is it that you have been, and this is after many times, why is it that you are so intent on this issue? And she never looked at this issue, she never had abortions, she never looked at this issue as something to do with her psychology, her psyche. I said, have you ever thought of it, if you have an abortion, how you would feel? Or fantasize an abortion? Here you are going and screaming on top of your voice, saying, women should have the right to abort. Have you ever thought what happens when you are in a situation where you may have to choose abortion? She totally broke down. And she had then also some memories of her mother tried to abort her when the mother was pregnant with her because she was not physically strong and it didn't work, so she was an aborted baby who was not aborted. And all the stuff then came out of, you know, it had to do with her psyche a lot more than the choice. And then she realized she was trying to get back to her mother, and she just was in another place then. So when we make something only political and legal worse, then we go away from the psychological archetypal. And I think we need a precedent, we need people who are on outer level leading us to have some sense, they don't have to use the archetype, that all these decisions, all these rules and regulations and bills have other layers and other levels. And I think partly why people voted for Clinton, maybe because they thought somewhere that he comes from a family where the father died of alcoholism, he suffered something, maybe he is a little bit in connection, the ego is a little bit in connection with the self.
He's really an alcoholic.
Yeah.
He's a real American.
Yeah.
A real American.
And hopefully has the depth to the understanding of the depth, not just the rebellion. Oh.
And then that's when he decided as a policy.
So he brought totally himself into the conversation or lecture. And that's what we're looking for, the connection to more, something bigger than just ego, just competence. He did?
Yes.
But he didn't, though. Bush had a child, died in leukemia? Really? No, because his heart was not in the campaign. See, he just went for the party, I guess. That's why he sounded so ridiculous, yeah. Yeah, that's quite possible. 90% of us are not. It's also a matter of carrying the projection of the party. And you, and as you know, I don't know how many of you have experienced consciously the projection when something is coming to you. As therapists, you have it all the time, or a performer, or whatever. As a married woman or as a lover, you carry projections of the other side, and when it becomes projection after projection and too much to carry, it's not possible, you die of it. So
one thing that really surprised me on the radio yesterday about Bush, because I've always found him pretty disgusting, you know, when you do it. And I guess he was advised in the first part of the debate to demand that Clinton bring forward his draft record.
Mm-hmm.
Could have been catastrophic.
Well, also, I don't think that the public really cared. I mean, he kept badgering on Clinton's character issue.
Well, at that point, mm-hmm. in the first debate, it could have been very significant.
That could be.
Yeah.
That could be.
And they were begging him to do it, and he wouldn't do it. Mm. And later, when he got exhausted, he became, you know, verbally ugly. But that really shocked me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I think maybe he couldn't do that, go that far. Yeah. And the quail, and he carried it. See, you have to give him some credit. He did not reject it. And what you're saying, Bush rejected that advice. And of course that shows that he has some individuality, some self coming through. Quail, maybe the self is way out somewhere. I don't know, it's terrible because you're all laughing at his expense. Okay, but he went on. He's smart enough to, yeah. He loves to be the younger son of the father who may be failing. So he was, I think I have no doubts that he's terribly loyal to Bush. He didn't just say it. He was very loyal to him. And that's his karma or his archetype. You are out of the office, public office. You are really out. Unless the convention time, or then you can give a speech, they can invite you. Even then, you're not sure that they'll invite every president, for former president. So when you are former, it is made out of you. The sacrifice is made of you. Life insists on it. But why the consciousness is important is to then go with it. And that's the hardest thing for ego to do. Ego will do anything. They'll say Democratic Party nowadays is gone very bad. They don't really respect the old-timers. We would always use the other people to blame for it. And then we think we have taken care of it. But we never would look at ourselves and say, if they don't invite me, maybe I have nothing to say to them. Maybe I have run out of what I have to say. You know. And so instead of saying, these people should know better, so I send some vita or proposals or something, I push with the ego. But ego had such a hard time realizing, I don't have to be perfect all the time. I don't have to be so interesting all the time. Any of you play the role sometimes in a party or in your family, the jester, you know, the one who makes people laugh, and you realize one day that you don't really want to do it, and you keep doing it because it has such rewards. Everybody says, wow, you know, every time Carl walks in, the room lights up or something. It's a wonderful, you know, hook for projection. And there comes a time because psyche in its own way has to move also. You don't feel like doing it. But you go on doing it by habit, and that's what I felt about Bush also. He didn't want to do it, but he didn't want to acknowledge it. Then you really get tired. That goes with profession, goes with relationships. There are friends who die. Friendship dies. Love dies. If something, anything that is born dies, and we hang on, we don't like to think that something so wonderful as love, and even more wonderful like friendship, can die. And if you look around, the more you are getting connected to the self, the more old friends might be lost and have to be sacrificed. And there's a common saying that if you are really in touch with yourself, you are lonely. It's a misnomer. You are really not lonely. But the outer community may change because the inner community is becoming more, you are becoming more aware of. And I've seen people who have gone through in psychological work hardly ever feel lonely again and hardly ever feel scared being alone. If you really go into yourself and go through all the initiations internally, the fear disappears, fear for external things. Of course, you'll be careful not to go to a part of a city where you may be attacked, but you do not feel that anxiety anymore. Uh-huh. Well, if you're physically unable, you mean. Mm-hmm. Irene de Castillo, you know, her book, Knowing Woman, has a very nice chapter, the last part, and she says, we underestimate from our point of view, let's say you are a daughter of a mother who is old, and as a middle-aged daughter or a young daughter, you are looking at her situation from your point of view, and you are eager to help her. with new CD records or I don't know what else, or videos or books which are in videos, or a trip on the cruise ship or whatever. And of course, she doesn't know it, but she's perhaps dying to have some solitude. And she talks about solitude is another word which you hardly ever hear. Think of a week goes by, which words you don't hear and which words you hear. It's an interesting exercise. And I can guarantee you the words you hear again and again and again have to do with ego, a lot more. And the words you don't hear would be the deeper words. Solitude is another word nobody mentions. Even the advertisements for retreats and things, except for maybe a religious retreat, people wouldn't use that word. And you know the old people's homes that come up in city edges, high-powered, nice ones, with doctors in residence and so on. And if you look at their advertisement words, it's fascinating, because all their words are geared to giving you more community, giving you more people. And they're trying to say, leave me alone. They might not know it, but just watch old people in your family. Many times they would love to be left alone. Like the dog and the cat doesn't want to be cuddled all the time. We do it because of our need. So when somebody, and nursing is a wonderful profession to watch that. Anybody nurse here? Ex-nurse? Nurses, the best nurses are the best nurses because they never look at their own needs. And that's the archetype of the nurse who can sacrifice herself. But then the price is a big one. Because what happens is that often, in my experience, nurses die very miserable death. They also contract the disease, most probably they have been helping others with. And it's the kind of irony of fate often. I can't prove the point, I don't have that much statistics, but I've seen it again and again. A nurse who is in psychiatric hospital, helping the psychiatric patients, at the end of her life goes crazy. Nurse who worked in the oncology department develops cancer. And you can, of course, come up with practical suggestions because she's exposed to radiation or whatnot, but she does not know when she gets it, she does not know how to deal with it when she has been advising everybody else. And we, in helping profession, whether nurse or therapist or teacher or whatever profession you might be which is helping, we have to be extremely careful not to forget that we have to help ourselves. Otherwise, we can't help somebody else. We do it through others initially, but comes a time we have to sacrifice that. When we linger, the need to help somebody instead of helping myself. Yeah. And mythology has wonderful examples of this kind of stuff. You know, if you tell the Psyche story, Psyche was given these three cakes when she was going to the underworld, and there was this old man who was hungry, a beggar. I said, please give me a little food. And she was, of course, tempted to help, because who wouldn't? Kindness is a virtue. But something in her stopped her. And she needed that cake for bigger purposes, to give that the dog who was guarding so that she could come back with something which was essential for her redemption to marry Eros. So we need to know sometimes not to be overly kind. And the nurses, many nurses I saw in practice, in analysis, are basically very angry people. And they're angry, even consciously angry, because they're paid very little. They do worst of the dirty jobs that in the hospital that goes on. They're the ones who deal with the death. They're the ones who are there at night. The doctor isn't. And they're paid very little. So they have all these reasons to be angry, but they don't stop and think, why am I doing this? Of course, immediately people find all sorts of conscious answers. Well, I'm 55, how can I get into another profession? So it's better than something, it's rewarding when somebody tells me thank you. All these things are true. But one has to look at, especially in helping profession, am I helping myself as well? I can't help somebody else until I help myself, whatever way that is. And it also keeps the person humble. Do you know how much power we have when we make somebody dependent on us for help? Tremendous amount. And people hate us. And that comes up in analysis. And that's why, back to ritual, that's why we need a ritual. We need the hour to be bound by payment and timing and also confidentiality, because the ritual protects somehow this over-expectation and the anger of not being met. And in fact, then you can use the anger against the therapist as part of the work. Yes, like the patient comes to be healed and cured, and therapist is not, in his eyes, not doing it. So the patient is angry. But he cannot be that angry because he knows it is bound by a ritual. There is a third factor involved there, which is, call it unconscious, call it gods, call it whatever you want. It's not just two people's egos. People who work with death psychology, unconscious, they know they're just the instrument. So the patient cannot be totally angry personally. And patients know that. Somebody would come and say, I'm very angry with you. As I was driving here, I really didn't want to come, but I came. I'm very angry with you. And they immediately would say, I know, it's not really you. And, you know, the intelligent patients know that. But what they're angry with is that rejection of the expectation. And the patient has to learn to sacrifice that, and then the real work begins. And if the analyst gets angry because the patient is angry and starts fighting the patient, saying, but why are you angry? I haven't done such and such and such. Then analyst's ego got involved in the patient's ego. And you call it then you are possessed into the complex. Then it's a deadlock. What is that Pero uses all the time? Gridlock? We need somebody like that, a fool sometimes, to lighten things up. I thought he was a very interesting, psychologically very interesting intrusion. See, he dropped out. He's that stranger who comes in dreams, comes in life. He drops out. He's that unwanted relative or unwanted neighbor. There are wonderful movies, by the way. I have a whole list of references and movies that which are relevant to the initiation in America. So I have it written, typed out, and somebody can make copies. It's one page. I forgot to announce it last night. There are hundreds of movies where people don't like people, and they... What about Bob? There's a movie called... Yeah? This patient is always around?
Yeah.
Okay. No, this... And that patient had to bring something to this psychiatrist's life, which was barren, wasteland. Yeah, he's a helper. I'm sure he's very successful. And then Bob, the psychotic, has to come. If you haven't seen it, please do see it. It's really funny. To bring the juice in his life. And his whole family likes him. He's the one who cannot keep the family out. He's everywhere. So Perrault first drops out and then comes back because he needed to be there. And he's that fool and that humor and that man who can laugh at himself, the gnome and the leprechaun, that is needed in these two opposed archetypes, the Senex and the Puer, and that we need something in between. And I think he was not so upset. He knew he wouldn't win, but he was not even that upset. What, 5 million or 10 million he spent for the... He was 60. See, I can't even comprehend 60 million. But anyway, for me, 6 million is enough. And then he dances. The moment that it was clear that Clinton is going to win, he dances with his wife. I thought that was so lovely. It was a very traditional gesture of celebration. It's an Eros expression. He didn't even send a message to Clinton. He just dances with his wife. The way he laughed at himself in the debates. And the way he laughed at himself in debates, he really lightened, brought the humor in, brought some soul in. Well, I'm all ears, and then he laughs. Laughs at his own body. That's nice. Yes?
I find that paradox with this community thing.
Mm-hmm.
And something, you know, what you hear around here a lot is, that comes to my mind is that, if we just see that we're all one, you know, that makes...
If you see the world?
Yeah, if you see that the world is all one. And I can't help seeing the American community, and that is like as you say, cultural American dream and all that stuff. It's my shadow.
Well, you are American, for better or for worse.
Right. And I understand in my soul why I am American and how I resonate with this, the deeper issues of what America is at its root.
You see, we criticize.
When you say you go into these, you find yourself in a sacred space wherein you can connect with the divine, you are the initiate. And the reason why you're going through these initiations is to be a blossom in the community.
Not necessarily. To be connected to yourself. Community would see that you are the friends that you left behind because you are working with yourself. The old community has disappeared or dead. They are in awe when you are really getting connected to yourself. They might not say it to you, but they somehow respect you. But then the new community comes. But you don't even need the community that much anymore. You are contributing to the community in a different way by being who you are. It sounds very unusual. But when you talk about, I want to mention something else about criticism, about one's culture. I've never seen any culture where people are so self-critical as in America. And I had to think about it many, many times. And I was thinking, and I used to admire it, because I thought, my God, these people are so honest.
It's
criticized itself.
People will apologize to you when you come in.
To be too, because they're not good enough. I don't know. I don't know about Japanese culture. I can only handle one at a time. Let's deal with America for the time being. I think it has to do with the youthfulness. Because young people have to dislike their parents to get away. So what is remaining as a puberty right in the modern society is this tremendous clash. Nowhere you hear so much problem of the teenagers as you hear here. Teenagers is a cultural calamity in America. And anywhere you don't see that calamity, because we don't have the puberty rights here anymore, so that the children take it on their own hands, unconsciously, to separate. And that's why when you have first fight with your daughter or your son over whom to date or what to wear or what not, remember this is the only way she can go through her puberty rights. But to know that, then you don't get literal and stuck. Then you don't just try to badger her, not this pair of stockings, that other pair of socks. Then you know why she's doing it. And I think I feel very sympathetic toward the teenagers because they don't have a guide. They're in this incredible hormonal, physical, emotional upheaval, like an earthquake, if you remember your youth, beginning of youth. And they didn't have any mother's brother or the priest or the culture or the tradition to tell them that this is okay and we are going to help you to pass through, even though it might be painful. So everything becomes literal. The mother is fighting with this daughter, the husband is avoiding saying anything about this, and all this going on. You don't see what's happening to this kid. He's going to play football, doesn't do his homework. The whole stuff is all remains literal. And if the parents know that the children are really desperately trying to separate and they have to fight in a way that they really hate their parents, and then it would be easier to separate because there is no initiation ritual. So I hit that somehow. I said the adults criticizing the culture have to do it being in that place, the teenage place, if we take the culture as a young culture. Part of midlife, and I'll stop before we break, we started with midlife in the big morning. Part of midlife initiation has to do with claiming what is mine, claiming what is my nature, claiming what is my culture. And that's the sacrifice. Because many of the things you have to claim, you don't like.
Well, that's the going way back and then stepping forward.
Yeah.
Going way back.
By claiming the cultural bad things, you are going forward because you are becoming yourself. So Americans have no choice but to claim the fact that it's an extroverted culture. Sometimes it can be stupid. Sometimes it can be youthful. I'm saying all the negative stuff first. But with that comes the strength that it has enormous energy. It has the capacity to laugh at itself. Look at Peru. It also has the Senex in it, but it's more... I mean, this is a culture which has all the good qualities of a youth. But the problem of that is that then it doesn't want to grow up. So when you are all in the growing up age, which is above 50, above 40, you have to claim what is something that you don't like. Like you have to claim the aches and pains of the body. Acceptance, I guess. And I guess in a way, if you want another language, I'm asking you to be that old-fashioned mother. And I would use the word mother. Who accepts no matter what the child is, even the mongoloid kid, doesn't go immediately to the medical doctor to change it. She just loves. And you see that among some black women in this country. You know, the children are going out, getting pregnant, bringing white kid, Hispanic kid, God knows what. And I knew a family, and this grandmother said, fine. And they're just bringing, that grandmother brings up those illegitimate children. She just accepts it. And I'm not saying it's good, but we need a psychological side of that to accept ourselves in our midlife and our culture, because we are part of that and we have taken part of that culture. Yeah. Okay, looks like the time is coming up. So we break and then we come back. Whatever you need, do you have your drink of water or coffee and everything? Let's put it away so it doesn't fall in. We're going to read a story, which is a midlife story. And it's a positive story, how midlife can, because we talked about so many bad things, negative things that can we have to deal with, face, etc. The story is an optimistic story and how midlife can offer something valuable to look forward to. And after, you don't have to interpret the story, we're not going to interpret the story, we're going to listen to it, just to listen to the story. And as soon as we finish reading the story and listening to it, I would like you to go away on your own from that point for 20 minutes, maybe. And take some papers, there's some papers, Lucretia, someplace, the newsprint. Yeah, you can take or tear it or take. We can also roll it up on the middle of the room. There's a big room there. Okay. Or just go take a nap. Somebody suggested a nap and have a dream. Or take a walk. But try to be completely alone and as much as possible with yourself.
There are some empty classrooms around.
Yeah. But before we start the story, I would like you to, do you know how to deep breathe? Deep breathing, which is something we do before meditation or prayer. And what it does, it's also an excellent idea to do it, those of you who work with people, to do it before the beginning of a session, each session when you work with people or anything you do. What it does, it centers you and it brings out the unconscious part of yourself to help you whatever you're doing. It can be also very good before you write a poem or write a paper. Okay. You take in, you inhale, and sit comfortably. The best thing to do is to put your palms of your hand upward facing. Then it's easy to relax. And you breathe in. As you breathe in, if you must think, if you can do without thinking the best, if you must think, your mind is wandering, think of good, fresh, clean air going inside. And you take as much air as you can, and then exhale, emptying your lungs, and think of dirty, bad air, all the poison and the stuff going out, if you must think. If you don't think, fine, if you can empty your mind. Well, do it 10 times, and then Cindy will read the story. And then you go out without any question or talk, and you come back, and I'll mention the time before you leave. Okay. And close your eyes.
Story called The Golden Tree from a Jewish source in India, it says. Long ago, there lived a great king with five wives. The king loved his youngest wife most of all, so the other queens envied her and whispered evil things in the king's ear. "She has not borne you any children," the queens told the king. this was true. It is because she does not love you, they whispered, and this was false. Finally, the king believed the jealous queens and banished his youngest wife, sending her away without any money or food. The poor queen did not know what to do, so she simply followed the road. When night fell, she found herself in a great forest and took refuge in a tree. In the morning, the queen climbed down and found an old man at the bottom of the tree. The queen took fright and turned to flee. "Do not be afraid," the old man said. And his voice was so kind and gentle that the queen stopped. "You are tired and hungry," the old man went on. "Come with me. You can rest and eat at my house." The queen saw a light shining in the old man's eyes, so she put her trust in him and followed him into the forest. The old man and the queen arrived at a small hut, and he prepared a meal using nuts and berries. The hermit set out a bed for the queen, woven from rushes, and when she lay down, she fell asleep immediately. As she slept, the queen dreamed that she wandered in a lovely garden with a beautiful pool. From the water grew a tree, and it was more marvelous than any she had ever seen, with leaves of gold and blossoms of diamond. As the queen stared in awe at the tree, an old man in a long white robe came up to her, the very man who had given her shelter. He offered the queen a golden amulet shaped like the tree in the garden, and the queen put on the necklace. At that moment, she awoke from her dream. She felt something around her neck, looked down, and found herself wearing a golden amulet. Just then, the old man came in from the forest bearing fresh fruit. "Good morning," he greeted the queen. She looked at him with amazement and finally understood that he had been sent to protect her. "Good morning," she replied. The old man smiled and set out another meal. As they ate, the old man asked the queen about her life, and she told him her sad story of being banished from the kingdom. "It's all the more unjust," she lamented, "because I know that I am pregnant with the king's child." The old man comforted the queen. "You can stay here until the king comes to his senses," he said, and the queen readily agreed. The old man was a master craftsman. He extracted gold and silver from deep in the forest and fashioned wondrous objects. But the most marvelous things he made were amulets, shaped like the golden tree in her dream. Strangely enough, the old man never tried to sell his work. Instead, he melted down his creations and fashioned new ones. This puzzled the queen, and she asked the reason for it. The old man smiled. "It is the creating I enjoy," he explained simply. The days passed swiftly, and the queen soon bore her first child, a baby boy. That very night, far away in his palace, the king was troubled by a strange dream. In it, he beheld a magnificent tree with leaves of gold and blossoms of diamond. As he moved closer to the tree, the king saw the face of his youngest queen reflected on the tree trunk. The king was filled with sorrow, for he bitterly regretted banishing her. He reached out to touch the queen's reflection, but then everything vanished and he awoke. Every night after that, the king had the same dream, and it tormented him. So he called all his sages and asked them the meaning of the dream. "You are remorseful for banishing your queen," the wise men and women said. "You must send messengers to find her and bring her back." So the king dispatched heralds to all the corners of his kingdom, but no one knew where the queen was. And every night when the king dreamed of the golden tree, he felt more agony and remorse. In anguish, the king called his soothsayers again. They consulted among themselves and then spoke to the king. "If the queen is lost," they told him, "the golden tree can still bring you comfort. So command the jewelers of the kingdom to make such a tree and your nightmares will end." The king summoned all the goldsmiths and they labored day and night until they created a golden tree more magnificent than anything ever made by human hands. But it was still only a shadow of the golden tree in the king's dreams, and his torment continued. In desperation, the king summoned the sages a third time. They murmured and pondered and finally turned to the king. "There is only one solution," they said. "You must seek this golden tree yourself." So the king left the palace the next day, disguised as a beggar, determined to find the golden tree. Everywhere he traveled, the king inquired about the golden tree, but no one could tell him where it grew. He wandered the length of the land, sleeping on the ground, desperate and disheartened. Then one day, the king entered a great forest and came across a hermit. The king asked the old man about the golden tree, and the sage smiled. "Yes," the old man said, "I know about the golden tree, but you are tired and hungry. Come with me to my house. After you eat and rest, I will tell you all that you need to know." The king rejoiced and followed the old man to a small hut. A woman and her child lived there, and they were none other than the king's youngest wife and his new son. The queen recognized her husband at once, but she wore a veil, so the king did not know her, and she said nothing. The old man set out a meal of fruits and nuts, and as the king ate, the sage told him about the golden tree. "It grows deep within this forest," the hermit said, and the king's heart leaped with joy. "Follow that stream," the old man advised, pointing outside, "and when you reach its source, you will see the golden tree." The old man paused. "But the closer you come to the source, the hotter the stream will be. Its water rises from deep within the earth." The old man closed his eyes and murmured sadly, "Many have tried to reach the tree, and most have perished. Yet there is a way." He bent down and removed his shoes. "If you put on my shoes when you step into the water, the heat will not injure you, and you can make your way to the golden tree. But you must remember to bring back my shoes. Otherwise, all your effort will be for nothing." The old man added gravely, "This is what I know. The rest is up to you." The old man gave his shoes to the king, and the monarch bowed in gratitude. The king followed the stream deeper into the forest. As the old man foretold, the water became warmer and more violent. Finally, the king heard a great roaring and clouds of steam billowed around him. Through the fog, the king glimpsed a flash of gold, and when he pushed forward, he beheld a luminous tree, the golden tree of his dreams. But the tree was surrounded by a whirlpool of boiling water, and the king despaired. "How can I reach the tree?" he cried out. "I shall die if I step in the water." Then the king remembered the old man's shoes. He put them on, gritted his teeth, and stepped into the maelstrom. To his surprise, the boiling water did not burn him, nor did he sink beneath its surface. Carefully, the king made his way to the center of the vortex and stood beneath the tree of his dreams. The king stared in awe because the tree was a fountain of molten gold. Each spray of liquid metal formed a branch of the tree and each droplet a leaf. The form changed constantly and yet always remained shaped like a tree. Hesitantly, the king reached out as he had in so many of his dreams. This time the tree did not vanish and he grasped a golden branch. The molten metal did not burn him, and when he withdrew his hand, he took a bough of the tree with him, solid and golden. The king exulted, for he had fulfilled his dream. He swam to the bank of the river, took off the old man's shoes, and hurried toward the hermit's home. Along the way, the king paused to rest, staring at the golden branch he carried. There on the burnished surface, he saw the reflection of his youngest queen, and he wept, regretting his harsh treatment of her. "Of what use is this golden branch?" he murmured to himself. "I've lost my dearest love." Sadly, the king arose and resumed his way to the old man's home. When the king arrived at the hut, he returned the shoes to the old man and thanked the sage for his help. The hermit congratulated the king, but the monarch only sighed. "I've touched the tree of my dreams," he told the old man, "and I've brought back a golden branch. But I cannot rejoice, for I have lost the woman I love most in my life." When the queen heard these words and saw the remorse in her husband's eyes, she stepped forward and took off her veil. "You lost me," she said, "but I have returned." The king recognized his wife at once and fell at her feet, begging for her forgiveness. The queen embraced the king and forgave him, and she drew her child forward so that father and son met at last. The king wept with joy and embraced the boy. Finally, the king and queen bade farewell to the old man and made their way back to the palace. When the king returned, he divorced his other wives and made his youngest wife the only queen. Then he planted the golden branch in the garden of his palace, where it grew tall and bright as the love between king and queen.
Okay, now it's 3:05. Why didn't you come here by 3:30? You can do anything you like with the story you just heard, or anything else. Oops. So, somewhere or other we find a way to separate. And then we want to be in a liminal stage, something in our psyche. And by this experience, perhaps you'd realize, those of you who are still wondering how to create a ritual, you'd realize that it just happens if we are allowing it to happen. In other words, through the day, if we allow a little bit of time to ourselves to get away from everything we're doing, a break, and then spend some time doing whatever comes to our mind or doing nothing. That break is important. That separation from the conscious world, the mundane world, might be very, very important. And as ritualistic experience you go through. So that's what I hope we went through a little bit anyway. Those of you who want to share what you have done and want to express, feel free, and we don't have to. We can react to the story also, or you can react to anything you want. And let's first see what you have done, if you want to share them, and then we can perhaps go back to some of the questions you may have, or some substantive, thoughtful things. Anybody wants to go first?
Mm-hmm. And the very obvious thing seemed like this whole thing going on. There wasn't, yeah, this picture.
Wait a minute, you had another daughter first.
Yes, I have a daughter. I have a daughter who's 27 now.
And then you had a little baby.
Then I had this visualization that I had a second child.
Visualization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it was, and the father of this child was not the father of my own daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it for a long time, and it wasn't really too long, but it took an earthquake to get me to write it down.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first thing. It also sent me into therapy because I realized that this was an experience that was, I felt myself moving forward, but I didn't have the courage to take the jump, and so I went into therapy in order to make that jump. The thing that I had a problem with at first, though, was that it just seemed to have some obvious overtones. What I really realized was that I, as a woman, was moving on into a different part of my life, that I was not only a daughter, and I was not only a mother, but I was a daughter and mother within myself over and over. And when I tried to look at the scene I was seeing as myself as a mother to my daughter, who's then taking another daughter, it became really kaleidoscope in effect. So now I have heard Chin, and I have a tape of Chin doing that story, and I have listened
this story.
To it. Uh-huh. I listened to it about a month ago, because the part that I've had a difficult time dealing with in that visualization is the animus figure, which I have not wanted to give up. And this started of taking at it and then listening to it again today is that not only did I give birth to a daughter, but I've also given birth to a son, because the animus figure has to take on a new role too.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a literal characterization of the way that I've seen animus in my life.
Mm-hmm.
But it's moving into a different part. I'm moving into a different part of my life, so even though animus may have archetypal is the way that I recognize that it's going to actually be a
thing too. Okay, so you didn't I didn't know that. Anybody else heard the story before? So you heard the story before, and today you heard it again. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
It had started triggering some of these things about 4 weeks ago when I listened to it, but today I was able to...
When you said...
When
you said you gave the daughter, the visualized daughter, to your own daughter, did you talk to her personally or you just did it in your mind?
I did it in my mind, but after I did talk to my daughter, I shared the experience with her.
Mm-hmm. Was she able to participate in it?
She said, well, you know I do that, Mom. And I said, yes, but sir, I think that it's going much further than that. I don't think this is really me giving you a daughter of mine to you. I think that it's myself, that you are representative of a daughter of myself who then is birthing another daughter.
But you see what we were talking about before, maybe that's what you wanted to your literal daughter to know that. And then you said that you're the daughter and the mother at the same time, and then you had to internalize it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how things happen, that the same story you had to hear twice to get into something. So this you think is your midlife initiation or
something?
Well,
it's triggering something else that I can think a little bit more on this.
Mm-hmm.
I had just really sort of set the animus figure aside. I didn't want to deal with that part of it, and that part of it sort of being forced down the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Internally being forced down.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Anybody else? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes when I'm asked to do something like this, I feel like participating, I feel really stuck. And part of the creatively and part of the theme, I guess, that I've really worked with over the last 10 years is how to get these polarities or alchemy together, you know, vertically handedness and things. How if I'm working on something over here and I'm asked to do something here, I've often had a feeling I have to leave that to come to this. And, when I heard the story, I thought of, I could still feel my ego working around a lot, and thought of it in an illustrative sense, and thought that I could picture a tree of life, and I could picture women leading a picture, and I sat there for a while and thought, oh, it's just what you get.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.